KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is the California Report. Coming up, the election is over, but the race is on. What Tuesday's presidential primary tells us about the road ahead for Clinton, Obama, and McCain. And how Asian Americans get hooked on gambling.
A lot of new immigrants, they come here in the, when they first started. They work in a lot of blue-collar jobs, and the English is not that great. When you go to the casino, it's totally different mentality. They treat you like king.
Also, a dining feast called the Whole Hog, celebrating the joys of pork.
That pig gave its life. So you want to make sure that you respect every part and treat it as it should be treated and let it shine for what it's worth.
Those stories, plus why a Grammy nomination for a fiddler from Los Angeles is hitting the wrong notes. I'm Scott Schaefer, and this is the California Report. The California presidential primary came and went this week, and the day that was supposed to be the end of the road turned out to be just another bend in the road for both the Republican and Democratic parties. Mark Baraback is covering the presidential campaign for the LA Times, and he's with us now. And Mark, let's start with the Republicans. John McCain walked off with just about every delegate that was on the table here in California. And I'm wondering, how much of a factor do you think that was in Mitt Romney's decision to drop out this week?
I think California was a big factor. Super Tuesday was not a great day for Mitt Romney, but I think if he won California, or if he could have made walked away at least with a fair amount of the delegates here in California, he might have had some incentive to go on. I mean, you could almost sense it on election night. They were hanging in there waiting for California. That was supposedly their fire break. And as you mentioned, he did not do well here at all. I think he won maybe two or three congressional districts in the whole state. And that was, you know, the proverbial final nail in the coffin for him, I think.
Now, McCain, of course, is not universally loved by conservatives in the Republican Party nationwide. How much of a problem does he have with conservatives here in California, do you think?
Well, I think it's the same thing writ large or writ small. Conservatives, you're right, they're not happy with their governor and they're not happy with John McCain, and he's going to have a lot of work to do bringing these folks together. The question for McCain, not just here in California, but nationwide, you know, is not just a question of whether these folks are going to come out or not. It's a question of to what degree there is enthusiasm. There's a difference between coming out and casting a vote and really going out there and working their hearts and their souls for John McCain. And right now, it doesn't look like they're real ready. So again, he's got a lot of work to do between now and November.
Before we get to Hillary and Barack, let's talk about immigration. Always an issue here in California. What is your sense of how it played out in the primary here for both parties, if at all?
I'm not sure it was a huge factor. I think it touches on some of what we spoke about. I think a large part of the conservative unhappiness and resentment toward McCain stems from his position on immigration, which it should be noted he modified through the course of the primaries. He was very much a backer of this so-called pathway to citizenship for immigrants that got him crossways with a lot of conservatives, and he sort of dropped that part of his platform and talked instead a lot about enforcement as a top priority. So I think, if you will, a lot of the damage was done for John McCain already as a result of his initial stance on immigration, and that put off a lot of conservatives. I think on the Democratic side, not a huge amount of difference between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. We can get to it. If you'd like, talking about Latinos, there is a huge, huge support gap there. The interesting thing is Barack Obama, if anything, took the more immigrant-friendly stance, if you will, saying he favored driver's licenses for illegal immigrants. Hillary Clinton opposes them, but still swamped him here in California as elsewhere once more amongst Latino voters.
It's looking very much like Obama and Clinton are going to more or less split the remaining delegates out there. And that, of course, raises the specter of the nomination being decided by these so-called superdelegates, members of Congress, governors, senators, party officials, and so on. What then?
Well, what then is, where do we stand at that point? I mean, it's my feeling that superdelegates, as you said, they're elected officials for the most part, members of Congress and such. They're self-interested animals, if you will. They're political animals. I think superdelegates are less a leading indicator than a trailing indicator. I think they're going to put the proverbial finger up and see which direction the wind is blowing at that point. Does it behoove them? I mean, you know, they're creatures of survival. They want to get reelected in November, and they're going to calculate who's better at the top of the ticket at that point for them. And their purposes, Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton.
I want to ask a couple sort of structural questions about the election here in California. There were a lot of votes cast by mail, I think up to 40% or so. And in the end, John Edwards got a few votes, Rudy Giuliani, people who had dropped out because people voted and sent in their ballots before they dropped out. Do you think there might be any ramifications of that next time around? Might they, for example, reconsider how wide open that window is? It was a whole month of voting.
I don't know if they will reconsider the window. I think a lot of people like the convenience of being able to vote when they choose. I think what you might see, though, is a lot of individuals saying, you know what, I remember last time voting for fill-in-the-blank, and either they were dropped out of the race or had second thoughts. Maybe I'll hold on to my ballot a little bit longer, and the consequence of that could be we might not know the results of elections, because what they do is they count those votes up to a certain point, then they lay them aside, they count the election day votes, and then they pick up this big pile. If you have more and more people waiting to count those votes, I could see a scenario where we might not have results for several days.
California, of course, moved its primary up from June to have a bigger impact on all of this. Do you think that the state accomplished what it was hoping to?
You know, I think the idea was to get people engaged and excited. And I can only speak anecdotally, but, you know, I went out to lunch a few times and I would hear people the next table over talking, literally debating Hillary versus Obama. I had a lot of conversations. I had conversations with members of my family who didn't care much about politics, were asking me for advice and thoughts and input. I mean, I got a sense, just anecdotally speaking, and it's there in the numbers, that there was a huge, huge amount of excitement. So I don't know that California decided, as a lot of people hoped it might, the outcome, but I do think there were a tremendous number of people who were very, very excited and very, very energized, and I think that can't but help.
Final question, Mark. There's a lot of talk now about an Obama-Clinton or a Clinton-Obama ticket. How likely do you think that is?
You know, it's hard to say. I mean, it's speculative. And as Barack Obama said, you know, there's a big difference between a Barack Obama-Hillary Clinton ticket and a Hillary Clinton-Barack Obama ticket. I mean, I think there would be a strong, strong push for that as a way to unify the party, particularly if this thing drags on. The counter-argument to that is, you know, we haven't touched on it, but we're really talking about history here. First African-American, first woman, you know, can you go for both in one bite? I'm not sure.
Mark Barabek covers politics for the LA Times. Casinos and card rooms provide a popular pastime for many Asian Americans, and with 8 being a lucky number in most Asian cultures, there might be some extra incentive to see just how lucky the year 2008 will be. For most people, an occasional trip to a casino isn't a problem, but some public health advocates worry about the growing number of Asian Americans who are addicted to gambling. Mina Kim reports.
San Francisco's Chinatown. About as often as cable cars bring tourists into this lively neighborhood, chartered buses cart Chinese Americans out for a day of gambling at casinos near Sacramento. The buses are almost always full, says Kent Wu, whose office is just 3 blocks away from one bus stop. Wu heads NICOS, a Chinese American health coalition. The group launched a problem gambling treatment program 10 years ago after a survey revealed the issue was widespread among the people they work with.
Nearly 70% of 1,808 Chinese American respondents selected gambling as a problem for their community.
But did this come as a surprise to you?
It was both surprising and not surprising. It was not surprising because almost every social worker in the community has experienced clients or families with gambling problems. What was surprising to us, though, was just the extent of the apparent problem.
A follow-up survey by NICOS found more than 20% of the Chinese Americans had signs of gambling addiction. According to national estimates, less than 2% of the general population is addicted to gambling. Tina Shum is a counselor who treats problem gamblers.
One, they have the time. Second, they have the money. Third, they have the urge.
Shum says her Asian American clients may get the urge to gamble more often because they did it growing up. Kids are often invited by adults to play games that involve luck and betting on happy occasions like Chinese New Year or birthdays. So there are positive childhood associations to gambling. On top of that, says Shum, casinos treat their clients very well.
A lot of new immigrants, they come here when they first started. They work in a lot of blue-collar jobs, and the English is not that great. When you go to the casino, it's totally different mentality. They treat you like king.
The VIP treatment hooked John, a software engineer from Los Angeles who prefers to be identified only by his first name. He bet thousands of dollars at the blackjack tables in Vegas.
Once you play big, you know, there's a pit manager there. They have Chinese host come to talk to you so nicely. Do I have a room? No, they give it right away.
John says casinos also reimbursed his airfare with gaming chips. When he lost all the cash he had on hand, they let him open lines of credit. It wasn't long before John found himself $750,000 in debt, separated from his wife and 3 kids, and contemplating suicide.
I just feel so regret. I say, why I become so stupid? Why I become this nightmare? It's really a nightmare.
That was 14 years ago. John eventually found Gamblers Anonymous and has learned to control his behavior. But community activists say the 12-step program doesn't work for most Asian Americans. Diane Ujia directs a problem gambling task force for the Asian Pacific Islander Community Action Network in Los Angeles.
Gamblers Anonymous oftentimes is not culturally comfortable for us. And so we need more local providers to be equipped with prevention and treatment skills so that they could do the services in language, in their communities, in a culturally competent manner.
But a study commissioned by the state calculated it would cost $280 million to treat addicts this way across all racial groups. The Office of Problem Gambling's budget is just over $3 million. Ujia managed to get some Indian casinos to co-sponsor a bill for a statewide prevention and treatment program last year, but the governor vetoed the measure, saying California already provides treatment.
So I think we will have to make another attempt, but perhaps leverage a little bit more legislative support.
Ujia is seeking new sponsors to carry another bill through the state legislature. In the meantime, casinos continue to target Asian gamblers. NICO's director Kent Wu says community activists simply can't compete with the casino's big budget ad campaigns.
And here we have a 15-second television ad that we promote, or a quarter page newspaper ad that we promote, but only on a sporadic basis because that's all the resources that we have available to us.
As for John, he isn't waiting for somebody else to warn his kids about the dangers of addiction. John says he's sending them a very different message than the one he got growing up.
I say, you guys had a gene, your bro had my gambling gene there. Although United States say 21, you can go to casino, doesn't mean that you gambling. You better think it over.
Now back together with his wife, John started a Chinese language group to help gambling addicts and their families break free the way he did. For the California Report, I'm Mina Kim.
California restaurateurs are bending over backwards these days to include words like local and organic on their menus. But pig cheeks? Back fat? Trotters? Well, that's another matter. The Ahwahnee Hotel in Yosemite National Park recently hosted a gathering of California chefs known for pushing the culinary envelope. Reporter Lisa Morehouse went to have a taste.
While a January snow falls on the Yosemite Valley, inside the kitchen of the Ahwahnee Hotel, Chef Mark Estes sharpens his knives and carves into a roast.
Kale, excuse me. And then we go sauce, and that's it. Yep, we'll slice some pork.
Estes is here for what the Ahwahnee calls a chef's holiday. The hotel has hosted these events every winter for the past 23 years. And they draw food lovers from across California to cooking demonstrations, kitchen tours, and gala dinners. And this event, called the Whole Hog, is dedicated to feasting on a favorite hoofed animal.
Pig's the best food in the world, in my book.
Esty of Moody's Bistro in Truckee prepared the meal's main course, porchetta. In this specialty cut, the belly, which we know is the source of bacon, is still attached and wrapped around the loin. This is Esty's seventh year here, and he loves the chance to introduce diners to parts of the pig they can't find wrapped in cellophane at the supermarket.
Looking at a pork tenderloin and then looking at the whole animal, people are like, one of those little things comes from that big thing? It's like, yeah, you know, there's not a pork tenderloin tree. They come from the whole part of it.
You know, we're here because of our friend the pig.
Chefs John Stewart and Dusky Estes hope events like this mark a cultural shift in the food world today, cooking with whole animals.
That pig gave its life. So you want to make sure that you respect every part and treat it as it should be treated and let it shine for what it's worth.
Like others here, Stewart and Estes have a love for pork that borders on the obsessive. Stewart has a tattoo of a butchering chart on his right arm, and he'll gleefully pull out his iPhone to show off pictures of a pig he butchered himself. Estes was a vegetarian for 22 years before a pork shoulder dish made her a meat eater again. But they really get excited about cooking with heritage breeds of naturally raised pigs.
Now there's a movement to stop the antibiotics and hormones, put the pigs back outside, let them pack on that luscious fat that is so awesome on your palate. We love our fat and when it comes to pork.
At their award-winning Sonoma County restaurants, Zazu and Bovalo, the husband and wife team hold snout-to-tail dinners. Stewart even cures a line of meats, bacon, and salumi.
So it's a pig heart that we braise with the Lambrusco, which is a type of wine.
Before dinner service, Stuart and the other chefs answer questions from the wait staff about their dishes.
It's delicious. You want to try it?
Jan Vogel from Carmichael, California, has been coming to these events for 20 years. She sampled the third course, a braised pork cheek on deep-fried radicchio with balsamic vinegar and pear puree.
I have never had cheek of anything, but they talked about it in the class that the pig is always chewing, so they have to really cook it a lot. Oh, that's really tender, very good.
Pork lover Anne Hurley traveled with her husband Chuck from Livermore for their 18th culinary visit to the Ahwahnee. She was thrilled with Mark Estes' porchetta.
Well, I can hardly believe what I'm eating because it's the most fabulous thing I've had in all my 78 years. And it's absolutely the most unusual dish I've ever had. Have some.
And with events like this catching on, it might not be long before pig cheeks are as easy to find as pork chops in your local butcher shop. For the California Report, I'm Lisa Morehouse in Yosemite.
If you want to try your hand at cooking with trotters and pig hearts, check out our website, californiareport.org. You'll find recipes from the whole hog chefs and a slideshow of the event. And that's our show for today. The California Report is a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director this week is Nina Thorson. Seal Muller is the technical producer with engineering help from Danny Bringer and Howard Gelman. Our online editor is Gabriel Cohen. Our interns are June Stinson, Ali Tabatabai, and Leanne Lucetta. Victoria Malione is our producer. Ingrid Becker is the senior producer. Our news director is Bruce Kuhn. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the Wesley Foundation for coverage of immigration issues throughout California. The California Teachers Association, because every child deserves a chance to learn, and no child succeeds alone. More information is available at cta.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation and Cal Hospital Compare, a new website rating hospital quality in California at calhospitalcompare.org.